Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment, or maybe he's with his family for Christmas. I've lost track. Our Real Science Radio broadcast for Christmas here on America's most powerful Christian radio station. That's Denver's 50,000 watt AM 670 K-Lite, as we call it, KLTT. We've broadcast a Star of Bethlehem program with the narrator of that planetarium program up at the University of Colorado in Boulder, just up the street from our studio here in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. Gil Buller with his astronomical Star of Bethlehem presentation at CU's Fisk Planetarium. So that's what we've done for Christmas in the past. This year, we move from the heavens above to the lowest parts of the earth, that is, to the mother's womb. You might recall that Hebrew idiom, that figure of speech, that man is made from the dust of the ground, from the dust of the earth. And in the book of Job, he famously said, Job said, "Naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there." Now, he wasn't planning to return to his mother's womb when he died, but it's a Hebrew idiom. We go to the dust of the earth, the lowest parts of the earth, and that referred to the mother's womb, that mysterious place from which the human race has come after Adam and Eve. Well, if we asked a medical doctor, how could it be that the fetus blood and the mother's blood don't mix, yet the baby's blood gets its oxygen from the mother's blood? Do you think that question could be answered? Well, Dr. Joseph Cazell, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Thank you. So glad to be with you today.
Well, it's an honor to have you on this program. After all these years, you've been an amazing voice showing how science supports a biblical worldview. So, wow, if we could answer that question, and then I have a couple others for you, Dr. Cazell. I'd like to find out about where the fetus makes its blood. I know adults, we make it in our bone marrow, but the baby makes it somewhere else. And I'd like to learn about the changes in the circulatory system from the baby in the womb to the circulation in the newborn babe. That's got to be quite an engineering challenge. So what do you think? We could cover those topics?
Absolutely.
All right. Dr. Cazell, you are an MD from the University of Arizona. You're a diplomat with the American Board of Emergency Medicine. You've got a couple dozen foreign missions in your experience, and you're with a pediatric residency in the Phoenix Hospital's affiliated pediatric program. So I do think you're qualified to address these topics.
Well, I did get quite a bit of experience when I was in a pediatric residency in the ICU nursery dealing with the sick and premature newborns.
Wow.
And so I dealt with these issues quite a bit.
You have delivered babies also?
Yes, altogether during training and in practice, about some 200 babies.
200 babies. What was your specialty?
Well, I initially trained as a pediatrician, but then I found I was supposed to go into emergency medicine. The Lord designed me for that. So then I practiced emergency medicine for over 25 years.
Oh, wow. Now, Jesus, when the Holy Spirit overshadowed Mary, that's a very different beginning of his biological development. He is the eternal God, the Son. But for you and me, our lives began with fertilization. For centuries, that's also been called conception. Can I ask you about the baby's heart beating? When did you say that they can detect the baby's heart beating?
As early as 6 weeks after conception.
Wow. Now, let me ask you about something in the early stage of the development of the heart Dr. Kazel, perhaps you've heard about this, that the stem cells that are differentiating, and so they're becoming then the cells of the heart. The earliest stages of the development of the heart, I have read where those cells begin pulsating, and they're pulsating actually before the heart itself is formed, before there are chambers of the heart, and that pulsating, after the cells divide and subdivide a million times over, their combined pulsating actually is what becomes the beating of the baby's heart.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, once those cells do differentiate into what we call cardiac myocytes or heart muscle cells, yes, they do form the structure of the heart and then begin to pump fluid.
So,
yes.
So that there might be a cartoon idea in somebody's mind that the baby's heart forms and then somebody throws a switch and it starts beating. But really it's pulsating the whole time it's being formed.
To a degree, yes.
Wow. Any more milestones you'd like to mention?
Yes. The organ formation is pretty much complete by 10 weeks of development of gestation, with the organs in the region of the throat being exception. They're not really finished until towards birth. And then wow. The brain is the last one to reach full development by age 8. And then in terms of size, but in terms of full connections of the various nerve cells, the synapses, that really isn't complete until around 23, 24 years of age. And that's why we have brainless teenagers. And then in between there, at about 12 weeks of age, is the development of the placenta is complete, and then it's ready for function and takes over the function of nourishing the baby.
Okay, now before we go further into the placenta, let me ask you about the weeks that you gave, that by 10 to 12 weeks, most of the organs are formed. By 10 weeks, you said, the beating of the heart. And there are other milestones that, you know, mom and dad, they see. The baby's fingers and toes can be seen on 4D ultrasound. The baby sucking his thumb. Even the baby going into sleep and sleep patterns in his brain waves. When the secular culture talks about the baby's milestones, it seems like they like to present them as though they happen later than they actually do. So you'll find articles that put off a baby sucking his thumb, you know, way into the second trimester, which is not true. But what is the difference when the baby's born and they say the baby's born at 40 weeks, but really, from the moment of fertilization, it's earlier than that, right, in a normal pregnancy?
Right. Well, it's two different ways of looking at the same thing. It's 38 weeks after conception or 40 weeks after the last menstrual period.
Okay.
And that's why there is this apparent but not real discrepancy.
Yeah. And the pro-choice, pro-abortion movement, they prefer to date things later. So they like adding those 2 weeks where for all these years on the air, we have dated the baby's milestones from the moment of conception, from fertilization.
Right.
So the placenta, it's an organ of the mother, or is it the baby's organ?
The placenta develops from the cells from the baby, from the differentiation of cells from those that become the baby or those that become the placenta. But they're all genetically from the zygote, from that first cell, the union of the egg and the sperm.
Did you say that the placenta then is pretty much functional by 10 weeks, 10 to 12 weeks?
By 12 weeks or so, yes.
12 weeks. So how is the baby growing and his cells dividing? How is he getting nutrients and oxygen before the placenta is ready to do all its work?
It's by diffusion, because the size of the embryo is so small that the diffusion is able to provide adequate supply of nutrients and removal of cellular waste products.
Wow, that is absolutely stunning. So the placenta does the work of what organs in an adult body? What is the placenta doing for the baby?
It does just about everything. It acts as the removal of waste products, as in the kidney, supplying oxygen, as in the lungs, metabolic work, as in the liver, the respiratory tract and the GI tract and the baby itself are not functioning since the baby's not breathing or eating. So the placenta really takes care of everything. It's an amazing, amazing organ.
Wow. We have a saying here at Real Science Radio, most major hurdles for evolution are extinction level events. In other words, if they had to evolve with an unguided process, then that species would go extinct rather than that whatever function is needed developing. I think as you and I continue, the audience will be able to see that so much of what happens in the baby's development and at birth, that these things, these are extinction level events if they had to just happen without design, without guidance.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it.
So, Dr. Kazel, before we get then to the circulatory system of the adult and the baby in the womb, any last milestone you'd like to mention?
Yes. One that's, I think, easiest for everybody to relate to is that when the mother at about 17, 18 weeks of development can feel the baby kicking or punching from the inside. And that the old-fashioned term for that is called quickening.
Quickening, and, yeah.
Right.
In fact, in American jurisprudence and history, if a woman was to be executed because she was found guilty of a capital crime, if the court could determine that she was pregnant, they had what they called the plea of pregnancy, and they would postpone the execution. That was from, I think, the first execution ever in U.S. history, had three men and a woman, and that was a factor. And so quickening, it's not when the woman becomes pregnant, but it's when she could feel the physical motion of the baby's limbs on her body.
That's correct.
Wow. So then the circulation of the baby in the womb, obviously it's got to be different than what happens in an adult. Perhaps we start by describing adult oxygenation, the circulatory system, and then we could try to think through the differences with the baby.
Sure. Let's start with the left side of the heart. The bottom part would be the left ventricle.
All right.
And so that's the part, that's the chamber that then pumps the blood out through what's called the aortic valve into the aorta, the number one main blood vessel. And then branches from the aorta go off to serve the head, serve the upper extremities, and then down to the lower body and the abdomen.
And serving the head, of course, the brain. So that obviously is a key part of the architecture of the system because of the importance of the brain.
Absolutely. And later on, we're going to talk about how the most highly oxygenated blood is directed primarily to the brain.
Wow. And because of the importance of the brain, that's such a central part of the architecture.
That's right. And then the aorta continues on serving the lower body and the extremities, the abdomen. And then there's the collecting system of the veins that brings the blood back to the heart. Mm. And it brings it back to the right side of the heart, to the top half, the right atrium. And that collects the blood from upper and lower body, which then goes through a valve into the bottom half of the right side of the heart, the right ventricle. And then the blood there is then pumped from the right ventricle to the lungs, goes out through the pulmonary valve, and then the pulmonary artery divides so that one branch goes to each lung, where then in the adult or after birth, the blood is reoxygenated. And then the pulmonary vein from each lung then combine, and then they serve to dump the blood back into the heart on the left side in the left upper chamber, the left atrium.
And then
it goes back down to the left ventricle, and then that whole cycle repeats.
You have simplified this in some of your video presentations. I think that'll work well for radio. But speaking of which, You're one of the main presenters in a series produced by ICR, the Institute for Creation Research. The title of that, you recall the title of that series?
Yeah, Dr. Made in His Image.
Made in His Image. That's right. What a thank you for that work. You have pointed out, to simplify what you've just described in more detail, blood flows from the left side of the heart to the body, back to the heart, to the right side of the heart to the lungs.
Correct.
Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. From the left side of the heart to the body, then back to the heart, from the right side of the heart to the lungs, and that cycle continues. And two things that should be obvious from what you just said, the arteries carry oxygen-rich blood away from the heart, and the veins carry oxygen-depleted blood back to the heart. But aren't there two exceptions to that? Isn't there one artery that happens to carry deoxygenated blood?
Precisely, and that's the pulmonary artery. That's the, in the adult, the pulmonary artery is what has the deoxygenated blood. And then the other exception is the umbilical artery, which we'll talk about when we get to the fetus.
Well, I think we're there now, because if we've just described the adult circulation, the prenatal circulation, the baby in the womb, the way you've described this, Dr. Kazel, if I could give an overview and then you could help us understand, in the baby, there are these shortcuts and bypasses. There's a bypass around the liver that has to close. There's a lung bypass that has to close. There are umbilical, there's vein and arteries that have to close. There's these shortcuts that are essential for the baby's development in the womb, but that all has to change once the baby's born. So can you talk us through that?
Yes. So let's start again with the left ventricle as the blood is pumped out of the heart to the body.
All right.
So that part is the same. We have to understand, though, that only 10% of the blood that's pumped out of the heart goes through the lungs.
Now, why would that be, and how does that differ from the adult?
100% of the blood that leaves the heart goes to the lungs in the adult, because the lungs are then functioning and, you know, the body's totally dependent upon them oxygenating the blood completely.
So in the baby's heart, 100% of the blood leaving the heart doesn't go to the lungs. Only 10% goes to the lungs. Why is that?
Well, because the lungs are not functioning. They're simply growing and developing. So that 10% flow is what is adequate for the lungs to be able to grow and develop.
Wow.
And since the lungs are not doing the work of breathing, you don't want all that blood going through there, because their lungs are not able to pick up oxygen yet.
Wow. And it would be an extreme waste of resources, and it would be detrimental to the development of the baby. So there's a change right there. We're somehow rerouting the blood flow from the heart. Only 10% in the baby in the womb is going to the lungs. Where's the rest going?
Through the body, as it would otherwise.
Okay.
And then after the aorta divides into go into each leg, there's branches that come off that then become the umbilical arteries that then go to the placenta, so that the blood can be reoxygenated, so that carbon dioxide can be removed and nutrients picked up and waste products given off to the mother.
Perhaps this is where my first question could be addressed. The idea that the baby's blood and the mother's blood, that they never mingle. They don't make contact, yet the baby is getting nutrients, especially oxygen, from the mother's blood, and the baby's blood is carrying waste products, including carbon dioxide, too, which is then removed by the mother's blood. How do those things happen if they're not intermingling, if they're not touching?
First of all, I just want to say never is a bit too strong. There are very small leaks, shall we say, is technical word there, where a little bit of the baby's DNA actually ends up in the mother's blood.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
But for practical purposes, you know, it's extremely, extremely tiny amount. Mm. So the real question is, how is that done? How is that separation maintained? And it is because, well, the mother's supply through the lining of the uterus, the what's called the endometrium, is very rich in blood vessels. And those supply blood that you could say washes up against the placenta. It meets the placenta.
Okay.
And then there is the one cell thickness of the outermost layer of the placenta, plus a couple layers of cells that make up the capillaries in the placenta that all belong to the baby. And so the nutrients and the oxygen and the carbon dioxide diffuse across the membranes of these three layers of cells.
That's astounding. So cells are extraordinarily tiny. We call them microscopic. An average adult has trillions of cells, human cells in our body. And when you have a membrane that's only one, two, three cells wide, that's just almost incomprehensibly narrow. So you're saying by the basic laws of physics and chemistry that there's diffusion from a greater concentration to a lesser concentration of oxygen through the membrane for the nutrients and oxygen going to the baby. They just pass through. And the waste products from the baby, including the carbon dioxide, it just passes through from the greater concentration to the lesser. It's astounding engineering brilliance.
Absolutely correct. And you just defined a diffusion gradient from higher concentration to lower concentration.
Wow.
In each direction.
Wow. So
what's even more remarkable, I think, is that outermost layer is one giant cell that thousands and thousands of cells have combined. So if you can imagine that the outer layer is just one mega cell.
One structure.
Thousands and thousands of nuclei.
Wow. And one cell, literally one cell?
Surrounds the baby.
Mm-hmm. Oh my. So the blood now with the transference of nutrients and waste products is still at the placenta. What happens from there for the baby?
Well, now we have that other situation where it's the vein that's oxygen-rich. The umbilical vein takes the oxygen and nutrient-rich blood back through the umbilical cord to the baby. And then it enters, and then there is the situation of the bypass where most of the blood does not go through the liver, which it will do in certain structures later on, but at this time goes past the liver and then joins the largest vein from the lower part of the body called the inferior vena cava. And then it joins that. And this is where we have the interesting situation of laminar flow, layered flow, where the two streams remain for the most part separate. Deoxygenated blood from the lower body flowing alongside but minimally mixing with the highly oxygenated blood coming back from the umbilical vein.
Dr. Kazell, I love the way you illustrated this. You gave an analogy in one of your talks with a photograph from the Amazon River, and it's where it combines with the Rio Negro, and the Amazon is loaded with silt, a light brownish color, and the Rio Negro is a deep, rich, dark color, and they're both flowing in the same riverbed, but they're very distinct. You see the two side by side, and so that's an analogy of blood going through the same passageway in the baby in the womb, but yet on one side it's oxygenated, and on the other side it's not.
Exactly so. And that separation remains to a great degree as the blood enters the right atrium, the upper half of the right side of the heart. And it's very interesting because it also involves the blood that's returning from the upper part of the body and the head through the superior vena cava. And there's a structure inside the atrium, the right atrium, called a Eustachian valve. It's the same word we use, same name as the Eustachian tube that connects the middle ear to the throat. And this valve is an engineering marvel in that that is one of the structures that helps direct the flow within that right atrium so that the maximal separation of the two streams is maintained.
Of the blood oxygenated and oxygen depleted.
Correct.
Why is it important to keep them separate?
This is so that the most highly oxygenated blood can go through the shortcut in the top half of the heart through the round window that is there connecting the two atria, the right and left atrium. And that is so that the most highly oxygenated blood can take the shortest route to get back into the left ventricle so that it can be pumped most directly to the brain and to the coronary artery serving the heart itself.
So you also give a simplified view of what's happening in the baby. Maybe I could mention that, and I'll be basically quoting you. But it's like a loop going through the baby's body, but that loop passes through the heart, and there's a side loop that goes off to the placenta, picking up nutrients and oxygen, getting rid of waste products and CO2. And there's another side loop that goes to the lungs, and we talked about that bringing just 10%. So what changes then must occur for the circulation, the postnatal circulation, to become adult circulation or newborn circulation? What has to change?
Well, the first thing we should talk about is this special structure, a small, very short segment of artery that connects the aorta to the pulmonary artery. That is the bypass that allows the detour around the lungs. So that 90% of the blood that would go to the lungs does not. Instead, it goes back into the aorta.
If that detour stayed open, the baby would suffer great difficulty in breathing. So that has to shut.
Absolutely. And that is very important for that to happen so that at the time of birth, that process of that closing off is initiated right away and completes.
Could we talk about how that happens? Because in this process, with all these changes that have to occur, there are different signals. For example, an increase in oxygenation will constrict some vessels and enlarge others. It's fascinating. So how does the shutoff of that detour, how does it happen?
It's absolutely amazing. And as you mentioned, the very same mechanism is used to obtain precisely opposite results in different organs. When the baby starts breathing after birth, the level of oxygenation is significantly higher than it was while the baby was still in the womb. And this increased level of oxygen is a trigger for that detour that connects the aorta to the pulmonary artery to close down and start constricting fairly quickly.
Wow.
Yet in the lungs, that very same stimulus causes the arteries, the small arteries in the lungs, to open up further. It's just absolutely astounding. And that's not something that could happen by random chance events, since
yes,
the same stimulus is causing the precise opposite effect.
Yeah, these are extinction level events. If all of this had to happen randomly, without foresight, without design, then no species could survive, these things being requirements for reproduction. So do doctors still sometimes smack the baby on the backside to get him to breathe?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's nice to receive that extra stimulus. But before we get to that, I want to talk more about how the detour around the lungs closes. There's another very important factor. Actually, there are multiple factors involved in this, but one of the ones that's really worthy of discussion is that there is a particular type of a hormone called a prostaglandin. It's a specific one that has maintained blood levels during the pregnancy. And then at the time of birth, the level of that type of prostaglandin drops dramatically, as in like to
zero. The baby.
And so how do you go, you know, with the race cards from 0 to 60 in so many seconds, how do you go from 60 to zero in so many seconds? And that is because the source of that hormone is the placenta.
Oh, wow.
And so when the cord, the umbilical cord, is clamped, then the supply of that hormone is zero. And then that's another signal to certain receptors in that small artery detour that no longer receiving the signal saying, stay open, stay open, stay open. And so that's another thing, along with the increased oxygen and many other factors, that tells that detour.
Well, even the actual birth of the baby stretches the umbilical cord, and that helps to constrict the blood vessels.
Well, yeah, now that, yes, that deals with the blood vessels in the umbilical cord.
Okay. That's another change that has to happen.
That's right. Because the function is no longer needed. The placenta needs to separate from mother, and also then the cord needs to be divided. And, you know, where we have our beautiful medical facilities in this country and other places, the, you know, sterile cord clamps are used. Hmm. But actually, biting of the cord also works as well.
And in nature with animals, animals are known to do this, right? They chew off the umbilical cord. But even humans that don't have the luxury of a midwife or a beautiful medical facility, wow. So then a shift has to occur from the placenta to the lungs, and perhaps we're at that point, but the lungs have been compressed. They've had liquid in them. Now they have to expand. So many things have to change in the baby's lungs.
Right. The emergence through the birth canal is purposely a bit tight, so that the fluid in the lungs can be squeezed out, and then the pressure sensors, the nerves in the lungs, are then stimulated to breathe and tell the respiratory center at the base of the brain to start breathing. And that's also why the slap on the bottom is to help stimulate that. And then the expansion of the lungs takes place, the arteries open up further, as we said, and the bypass around the liver closes rather quickly, dramatically, due to many of these same effects and others we haven't even talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things have to happen. But the other thing that's most important to talk about is the closure of that shortcut through the top half of the heart.
Yeah.
And there is a design so that there's a, think of it as a flap, or actually as a door on hinges. And so at birth, the pressure in the right side of the heart increases significantly, and the pressure in the left side of the heart increases significantly, and the pressure in the right side of the heart decreases. And then that causes that door on hinges, that flap, to swing shut. And in that very few seconds, then stops the shortcut across the top half of the heart.
Wow.
So that now all of the blood in the right side goes to the lungs. All of the blood on the left side goes out to the body, and 100% goes through the lungs.
Wow. So that door slams shut because of the pressure differential. And then you don't want that door, for some reason, opening up as the baby is, you know, becomes an infant and all. So that door then gets sealed shut, right, by the growth of cells around it?
Right, right. The tissue actually forms a solid wall, yes.
And then from that point forward, our heart has the separate right and left sides.
Correct.
Wow. So that brings us to my third question then, Dr. Joseph Cazell. And by the way, you're with the Arizona Origin Science Association. Thank you for your work there. The adult blood cells are made in our marrow, in our bone marrow. Where is the baby's blood made?
Well, initially, the blood is made in what is called the umbilical vesicle, which in past, due to evolutionary thinking and assumption, was called the yolk sac.
Oh, boy.
That's totally erroneous because it never had anything to do with yolk.
Right.
No yolk was ever present, and if you think so, then the yolk's on you.
Right. There is no yolk. There's no tail. There's no gill slits. We don't pass through a fish stage.
Right.
That's all fabricated to support a secular model, and it's all been falsified.
Absolutely. So then in roughly the first third of pregnancy, the blood is formed there. Then in the middle third of pregnancy, it's formed in the liver and the spleen. The blood formation shifts there, and also the type of hemoglobin changes.
Okay.
Due to the different conditions of acid-base balance and oxygenation levels, different kinds of hemoglobin are needed. And there's actually three kinds of embryonic hemoglobin that are used in that first third of pregnancy, or actually the earliest weeks of pregnancy.
So we need different kinds of hemoglobin because of the different environments of how it has to function.
So before the placenta functions, while the placenta is functioning, and then getting ready for life on the outside.
Okay, so you said the blood starts in the umbilical vesicle.
Correct.
Being produced. Then it shifts to the liver and spleen.
Correct.
Wow. And only then to the bone marrow. Why doesn't it start out being made in the bone marrow?
Because there's no bones in the beginning.
And there's no bones about it. So
That's right.
Boy, when we think about the wonder of the human body, and if we compare it to a machine, the most complex, a single cell is more complicated than the International Space Station. But if we look at the human body and we're in awe of it, as we should be, any organism really, but then we realize that it has to be viable from a single cell all the way through all the stages of development to the mature adult, it has to be viable at each stage. And the changes that occur, we're looking at one system. There's changes like this happening throughout that baby's body as it's developing.
Absolutely. And we've only talked about a few of the items. There's so many others we haven't even gotten to.
Yes. And you cover them, and you can't cover them all. You'd have to take a college level course, but you cover so many of them. The last topic is, you quote Jesus in the Gospels saying that from the beginning of the creation, God made us male and female. I remember Bill Nye, the Science Guy, that evolutionist atheist, he was debating Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis, and so much of what he said was outright false. And one of the things he said was, look at sexual reproduction. Look how fabulous sexual reproduction is. What more proof do you need of evolution? And when I heard him say that, Dr. Kazell, my jaw dropped, because the most famous evolutionists, from Richard Dawkins on down, they all say how bewildering it is to try to understand how sexual reproduction, male and female, how that could originate. They have no idea. And yet famous evolutionists use it as proof for evolution when it is admitted that they have not the foggiest notion how you originate sexual reproduction.
And it is so, so complex, even at the molecular level. Mm. Just the complexity of the interaction of sperm getting to the egg and what it has to go through. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. There's the social interaction of the two creatures. If it's a gazelle, you know, or a man and a woman, you need social interaction. There needs to be, at the anatomy level, the bodies have to be compatible. At the cellular level, at the molecular level, there's even like electronical and chemical issues that it all has to work. And to think that that's going to happen, that's another extinction level event.
True.
So, Dr. Joseph Kazell, what an honor to have you on this program. You're also with Logos Research Associates, is that right?
That's correct.
And you're also a professor at Arizona Christian University. How long have you been there?
9 years. And what I love about the place, many things, but one of them is I have total freedom to teach and am encouraged to teach the young earth creation model in my classes.
Oh, that's exciting. And our audience will be happy to hear that when we've interviewed regarding a soft tissue triceratops, Mark Armitage, Dr. Kevin Anderson, you were on that dig, weren't you, in Montana in the Hell Creek Formation?
Yeah, I was on the second dig. Dr. Anderson was on the first one. I was on the second one. Yes.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you for doing that. That's been a great area of excitement for creation science, all the biofossils that have been published in the world's leading science journals, soft tissue and dinosaur bones. So exciting. So thank you. Merry Christmas, Dr. Kazell, to you and your loved ones.
Thank you, and to all of your listeners as well.
Well, you're very welcome. That was Dr. Joseph Kazell with the Arizona Origin Science Association. This is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. Our website, rsr.org. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the